It is a chilly Tuesday morning, but then again on January 13th, that's what you should expect, right? At least I would hope for that. I don't want it warm like it was, and then we got mosquitoes and grass and all that mess. Anyway, highs of 57 today, 65 tomorrow. Then it cools off again, 51 on Thursday for a high, 64 Fridays, dry through the weekend with highs in the mid to upper 50s, so you can make your plans accordingly. Andranika Morris joins us now, president and chair of the Greater New Orleans Housing Alliance. Good morning, Andranika. How are you?
Good morning, Tommy. How are you doing?
I'm okay. We're here to talk. Well, Happy New Year, if it's not too late for that.
Happy New Year.
We'll go to 15th. Yes. I'm going to make the deadline the 15th on Happy New Year.
I like that.
Let's talk about affordable housing. How much of a problem is it in the city? And first of all, I guess we need to talk about some, you know, because you deal with this every day. I've dealt with it before, but maybe some people don't quite understand what it is that we're talking about. A, are we talking about the city of New Orleans proper or the area? And B, how are we defining affordable housing before we get to how big of a problem is it?
So that's a great question, the way to start it off, Tommy. I love that, and I appreciate that. So number one, we are talking about New Orleans and the region and Louisiana and the country. But we live in Louisiana. We live in Metro New Orleans. So we want to focus on those. And that's how we've got a lot of the initiatives set up and stacked up. But affordable housing is an issue everywhere. And it's really extreme in Louisiana. And it's really extreme in the Metro area. And it's really bad in New Orleans. We have lost, in New Orleans alone, about 30,000 people in the last 8 years who've been pushed out, who've been displaced. And in the region, it's a bit more. It's over 40,000 in the region. And Louisiana, as a result of this, this is a challenge all across the state. Louisiana is the only southern state that's not growing.
Wait, so we know that we've lost 30,000 because of the lack of affordable housing?
Yes, correct. They can't afford to live here, and they're getting pushed out.
Okay.
Yes.
So how are we defining affordable housing, Andranika?
Affordable housing isn't a type of housing. It's a state for the folks who live in it. If the household is spending more than 30% of their income on their total housing costs, they're living in housing that's not sustainable. That's how people end up getting evicted. That's how people end up being foreclosed on. That's how people end up deciding to sell their home and move somewhere else that's less expensive because they don't have enough money coming in. That's retirees. That's people who work 40, 60 hours a week. That's people who are living with disabilities. There's a range of affordability, and it's individualized for each family. So that's when we talk about the need for affordable housing, that half of the people, for example, in New Orleans can't afford the housing. That's based on their income and what their total housing costs are, so their rent and or mortgage and their utilities. And if that's more than 30%, that means that they can't save. That means that it's not sustainable. It's that they're robbing Peter to pay Paul. They're living check to check, and it's not sustainable. When something happens, they get tumbled off, and things are happening, right? Beyond the disasters, we're also seeing insurance and utility costs skyrocketing because of a number of issues, and those are things that are upsetting the issues. That's why in New Orleans, we've got about 40,000 empty homes and apartments, 10,000 of which are occupiable, but the landlords can't afford to rent them. The homeowners can't afford to sell them because no one can afford what they have to charge. And they're sitting empty right now. And this is a loss of revenue to the city. Go ahead.
Let me just jump in for a second. I don't mean to interrupt you, but it would seem like an empty apartment or an empty duplex, whatever you want to call it, is like an unsold concert ticket. That's revenue I'm never going to see. So why would a landlord not rent, say, for a portion of what maybe they could get on the market? Why would they leave it empty? That makes no sense to me. What am I missing here, Andranika?
Well, you can bring down the operating costs. We incentivize vacancy in this country. You can bring down the operating costs. You can, especially if it's a business, you can book it as a loss because you're not renting it. You can apply
because of the tax advantages.
Yes.
Okay. Good.
And the operating costs. Like because you've got to pay the insurance on it. You've got to pay the upkeep. You got to make sure that it's not a blight on your neighbors. So that owner has to still invest in it. And if you can, but if you can't get enough money to cover those operating costs, the incentive is you can bring down the operating costs by leaving it empty.
So what's the answer to that?
Well, number one, the answer to that is we've got to address the core issue, which is insurance, right? We've got to talk about addressing insurance. And then we've got to talk about helping connect folks who can rent that property, who could buy that property to them, and the making sure that the numbers work, that those landlords understand what the issues are and where the costs need to be in order for the average New Orleanian, the average resident of this area to afford the housing.
So you got 40,000.
That'll make sense. Yeah.
Yeah, you got 40,000 empty. You got 10,000 that are occupiable. You got 30,000 that have been displaced. You see where that, to just the layman, would make no sense at all?
Oh, yes, it does. It is a big part of the problem. Yeah, because it's counterintuitive, right? We believe in market pressures, that because the market pressures would say, well, they'll just drop the rent. They should just drop the rent and lower the price. And the market pressures, like insurance, because insurance doesn't move like that. Insurance doesn't say, well, these people can't afford our insurance, we have to drop our prices. Because that's not what their prices are based on. Their prices are based on the risk and the need for insurance. And so if you're a higher risk area and you don't have fortified roofs, you don't have the infrastructure investments, you're a higher risk. And the insurance companies will lose the money. They will, hey, you can't afford to pay what we require. They drop people all the time for that. That's a business pressure. That's a operating pressure that exists, that homeowners, property owners, renters don't have a lot of control over. And that's a huge business, and it's a huge industry. And they're able to do that because they'll just back out of a market and say, we'll go somewhere else.
We'll take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back talking to Andronika Morris, President Chair of the Greater New Orleans Housing Alliance. I understand all of that. I do know some things are fixed, like if you got a mortgage on the property, you're still paying that. So you would think you'd want something coming in to offset a little bit of that, but apparently not. I guess it goes to the tax code and everything else. 721 more when we come back. If you got any questions or comments, 504-260-1870. I will be glad to entertain them and pass them along to Andronika Morris. Traffic now, WWL. All right, Tommy Tucker, 726, here at WWL, talking to Andronika Morris, President Chair of the Greater New Orleans Housing Alliance. Every time we have these conversations, I get a couple of texts from people that make this not a business thing, but a personal thing, and I never did quite understand that. Who are we talking about, Andronika, when it comes to not being able to afford to live in the city?
We're talking about people, right, you were talking about, in order to rent an average apartment in the metro New Orleans area, you need to be making about $25 an hour. So we're talking about people who make less than folks who make $25 an hour. That's to rent. And that's rent based on the cost that we have right now. We're talking about people who make less than $52,000 a year, not able to make the math work on the affordability as renters. And we're talking about ever increasingly now, about 30% of homeowners are struggling with these skyrocketing insurance costs. And so those income levels, those vary, because you got a lot of people who are retirees who they paid off their houses. And they have pensions or Social Security, and the math used to work a few years ago. It doesn't anymore.
Aha. Right there, when you said the math used to work several years ago, but it doesn't anymore. And that leads me to, as I look at the clock here, Andronika, I want to make the most of our time. That leads me to my next thought, which is, you can't look at tomorrow or next week. You have to look at 5 and 10 years down the line if you're going to be in any kind of public policy position at all, or look at any
kind of
long-term solutions or to problems or trends or what have you. And I guess what I'm thinking is, as fewer and fewer people are able to get on that equity ladder and buy a home, it seems as though that's going to put more pressure on the rental market as salaries fail to keep up. With inflation, it seems as though that's going to exacerbate it as well. Talk about, am I on anything here or not?
No, you're right. That's right. You've got to be looking 5, 10 years, and that's one of the things that we do with our new Housing for All plan. That closed out our 10-year plan that launched last year, is what do we need 10 years from now to get to the place where folks can be stable and we can get back on a growth trajectory, because we want the city and the metro area and Louisiana to grow. We want it to be stable. We want people to put down roots and have families and retire here with confidence and decide to stay and raise their families here and not be shuffling around. And so and that allows businesses to stabilize and they themselves to grow and to keep pace with inflation and to build genuine wealth as a community. And that wealth is not extracting from its people. Its people have the wealth,
right?
And they have options and agency and all those things. So that's what we're talking about.
So
and that's how you do it.
People, let's say, let the market decide. What they don't realize is, okay, you can let it, you can go absolutely laissez-faire and let the market decide. But if you do, there's going to be a lot of economic displacement. There's going to be a lot of heartache, misery, pain, et cetera, during the course of that, and a lot of uprootment and people moving around and making choices that they maybe don't want to make. What would
That's
be
right.
the first step toward fixing this, Andranika?
Well, the first step towards fixing it is implementing in New Orleans. We've got our housing trust fund, and we need our CEA signed. It's something that the new mayor can do in our first 100 days. She's committed to being judged by stopping the displacement, stopping people from being pushed out of New Orleans. And we want to welcome her to that commitment. We're so happy that she's led with this as a priority. And she can get a quick, easy win by executing the CEAs for the Housing Trust Fund and getting the money out the door.
Thank you, Andranika. I appreciate your time. We'll talk to you again.
All right. Thanks, Tommy.
Have a good day. Oh, and one more time, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
All right. We'll take a break. We come back. We'll talk about what's going on in Iran and the Middle East and the protests that are going on there. Right now it's time for WWL First News, and for that we go to Ian Ozan. And Matters International as well, 7:46, 14 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by our friend Bruce Jenelson, professor of public policy, political science at Duke University, previously worked in the State Department, and on the Middle East process. The president was on the plane, so it was kind of hard to understand what he said, but I transcribed it. He said, there seem to be some people killed that aren't supposed to be killed. These are violent. If you call them leaders, I don't know if they're leaders. It's just they rule through violence, but we're looking at it very seriously. The military is looking at it, and we're looking at some very strong options. We'll make a determination. Bruce Jenelson, good morning. How are you?
I'm good, Tommy. Hope you are as well.
Yes, sir. Let's talk about this in relation to what happened during the Arab Spring. First of all, if you can give us a brief reminder of what happened during the Arab Spring. There was some protests in Iran. Iran is Persian, not Arab, just to clear that up right away. You take it from here, Bruce, please.
Yeah. So in 2009, there was what was called the Green Revolution in Iran. I actually was in the Obama administration of the State Department when this was happening. And what happened was the election was stolen from a more reformist, moderate candidate and given to a guy named Ahmadinejad, who, you know, wasn't a religious leader, but ruled very brutally. And the people in the streets kind of rebelled. It ended up being put down. And then we've seen this come time and again. About 2-3 years ago, the Iranian people went to the streets again over the killing of a young woman. And this time, even more people apparently in more parts of the country, not just the big cities, and they're being even more brutally repressed by the government.
So this comes down to whomever controls the military controls the government. Accurate or not?
Well, you know, it's a country that, since they had their revolution back in 1979, that put the Islamist regime in power and got rid of the Shah, who, by the way, was a pretty repressive leader himself, that we supported because he cooperated with us on foreign policy.
Let me jump in for a second, Bruce, if I may, because we tend
sure.
to put white hats and black hats on people. And although the Shah played nice with the United States, what was life like for people in Iran under the Shah?
It was pretty bad. He had a secret police called the Savak, and part of the reason he ended up falling and the Islamists coming to power was we very much went along with his repression, and there was no other, like, alternative to opposition, right? We repressed them all. And the then Ayatollah Khomeini was out of the country, came back in, and rallied people around, you know, being anti-Shah, and then they maneuvered out some of the more, you know, secular moderates, and they took power. And so right now you have the son of the Shah, who's been in exile in the United States, who's probably 60, 65 years old, and who's saying, I'm ready to come back. I don't think that's what the Iranian people want. They want to find a way to go forward, not backward.
Is there any way we would ever see a democracy in Iraq, or would they have to get past the theocracy first?
You know, you could find a democracy there over time, but it really depends, you overthrow a leader, and then what happens next often is turmoil, right? And so in Iran, it's interesting. The Iranian population, it probably has had the highest rates of literacy and education of any country in the Middle East except Israel, right? And women have had a role before. They continue to have a role now, repressed by the regime, but still have a role. So the basics are there. The kind of democracy they might have would be very different than we think of it. And to be honest with you, I'm not sure so many countries want to copy us right now. So it would be less repressive. It would be nationalist. It doesn't mean that it would be totally cooperative with the United States. It would still have to work out a relationship with Israel. But the fall of this regime does not necessarily lead to some, Thomas Jefferson or something coming to power.
What is the feeling of the country as it relates to, the religion, the Shah and the theocracy? They rule everything. And I'm just wondering if the people are lapsed in their beliefs or not, or are they as pro-religion, and this is all a terrible way to put all of this, but I think you understand where I'm going with it. Are they as pro-religion as the mullahs would have us think?
Yeah, that's a really good way of putting it, because they're not. You know, this is 40-some-odd years since the revolution, so you've had two or three generations. And when the revolution first happened, a lot of people said, the Shah was so terrible, so let's try this other way. Well, it's now their kids and grandkids that are there, and they're like, the bad news about the Shah is like old news, right? What I know now is this regime is very repressive in all my life, right? How women have to dress on the streets, what kind of education you get. And they're proud nationalists, In fact, when we bombed Iran in June, it didn't lead to this pro-American outcry. It was like, we don't like this regime, but we don't want anybody coming in here to run our country either.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up there when we come back, because that goes to the president's comments that I read earlier, and it might be, okay, we're picking at each other and we're fighting it out amongst ourselves, but we don't want a third party to jump in here. We're talking to Bruce Jenelson, our friend, professor of public policy, political science at Duke University, worked in the State Department on the Middle East peace process, so he's not just kibitzing. He's been there. He's done it. He's been in the rooms. He knows. 751 traffic now, WWL. 7:57, 3 till 8. Quickly back to Bruce Jenelson, our friend when it comes to Middle East affairs. He's worked on the Middle East peace process under a couple of different presidents. Bruce, what can the United States do when you come right down to it as far as either aiding people that are protesting or having anything to do with changes in the administration of Iran, et cetera?
Yeah, it's interesting. There are a lot of things that I criticize on President Trump sort of being pretty much of a bully. But in this situation, it's actually helping. It's got the government a little bit, worried, intimidated. But I don't know what military action does here. It's not like you go in and you can snatch the leaders. There are too many of them and it's too spread out. Two things. One is, this is actually where you really need diplomacy. If we were willing to mobilize our European allies and others from around the world, the Australians, the Japanese, and even some countries that are, sort of so-called global south, to put pressure on this government, then we'd have a real united front, and we'd also benefit from what they know about it. We have not had an embassy there since the hostage crisis back in 79 and 80. One of the consequences of that, we don't know much about the country. When I had my security clearances, it was in the State Department in 2009, 2011. The best briefing I got on Iran was from the Australian ambassador to Iran, because he was there, his people were talking to people. So we may have a couple sources that the CIA has, but we don't really know the country well enough to be the ones to figure out, how to make this government fall and what you do on the day after.
How do the other players in the Middle East feel about what's going on in Iran now, and what ideally would they like to see?
So on the one hand, Iran is Shia, and the others, like the Saudis, are Sunni. And we've always seen that as a big, unbridgeable split. The reality is, over the last three, 4 years, the Saudis and the Iranians have started talking to each other. When we bombed Iran in June, despite other good relations with the Saudis said, we're standing by our brother here, our Persian brother. But on the other hand, you know, they all worry, since they're not democracies, about governments falling. And so they kind of don't want to see this government fall because it might affect their people, too.
So when it comes to the divide between Shia and Sunni, is that becoming less and less as people age, people grow up, or is the religion, the fundamentalism still there? I know there will always be radicals, but generally speaking.
They have a lot of shared interests. So you have Saudis, United Arab Emirates, Qatar, all of which are Sunni, have improved their relations with Iran. And they have a lot of interest together. So they're never, you know, the bridges are being built much more than people said was possible, given the Sunni-Shia difference.
Thank you, Bruce. Appreciate your time, as always. Have a happy new year. Professor of Public Policy, Political Science at Dukes. We'll come back. Thank you, sir. We'll talk to Eric Smith about Venezuelan oil in Louisiana.